Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
A very good afternoon and welcome to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host for the show that brings different points of view together for conversations that matter every week and available around the world as a podcaster. You can join the thousands of people who download the show from week to week from our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And as we stand nearly at the eve of a new year, then I wish you all the very best for 2018 and hope that you can continue to have Unbelievable in your ear or on your radio throughout the coming year. Lots of exciting projects still to come here on the programme. I clued you into a few of them in the last couple of weeks, but we've got some really interesting stuff on the horizon for 2018. Can I encourage you as well to keep it here with Unbelievable straight after today's show on the profile? I'll be speaking to Bruxy Cavey. He's a friend of the show, actually, but he was over in the UK recently and I sat down with him to talk about his life and faith and his ministry as a church leader out in Toronto, Canada at the Meeting House, which he describes as a church for people who don't do church. We'll be talking about that, talking about his theology as an Anabaptist. You'll find out what that is. And indeed, his new book, Reunion. So look out for that straight after today's show, between 4 and 5. And you can find the podcast by searching for it online or on Podbean or on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. Just look for The Profile from Premier Christian Radio. Well, I'm looking forward to today's topic. We often debate apologetics, arguments for God's existence and the truth of Christianity on this program. Today, we're taking a bit of a bird's eye view on that whole subject. Let me introduce today's program.
You're unbelievable.
Well, on today's show, we're debating the methodology and value of apologetics. We're asking, is apologetics actually a dead end? And Sean McDowell and Myron B. Penner join me for today's program. We're looking at the rational defense of the Christian faith through argumentation and evidence. That's what apologetics is. It's what happens a lot on this show in debates between Christians and non-Christians. But today we're asking that sort of meta question about it. Does it work, or have we even got our whole approach wrong? Well, Sean and Josh McDowell have produced an updated version of Josh McDowell's classic apologetics book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. It's a book which was very influential in bringing many Christians into contact with defence of the Christian faith using historical evidence. And so in a sense, it stands as one of those, you know, classic books. And so it's going to be really interesting to hear about the updated version of that. But it does raise that whole question. What is the value in having books like Evidence That Demands a Verdict, looking at the argumentation, the evidence for the historicity of Jesus' death and resurrection and so on. Myron B. Penner is a church leader out in Bolivia, actually, who authored a book a few years ago titled The End of Apologetics, Christian Witness in a Postmodern Context, arguing both that kind of approach to reason and evidence beloved by many Christians in terms of apologetics is a bit like a modern form of idolatry and also largely a cultural dead end today. And so we're going to be debating this subject, I'm sure, in a helpful, fruitful and collegial kind of way on the programme. So a very warm welcome via Skype, both to Sean and to Myron on the show today. Perhaps I'll begin with you, Myron, as you haven't been on the show before. Welcome along. And in some ways, you're my worst enemy, Myron, because I host effectively an apologetics discussion show. But your book, it would appear, rather, you know, bluntly said, actually, apologetics, is it really worth, you know, anything in the end? Where did this all come from for you? Were you ever a fan of apologetics? Has it ever floated your boat before?
Yeah, actually, ironically, that's exactly how it started for me. Yeah, I remember very distinctly as a 17-year-old in grade 12, realizing I had been raised in an evangelical home And it wasn't like my parents sat down and said to me, here's a bunch of options for you. There's Hinduism, there's Buddhism, and we happen to be Christians, and we hope you are too. It was more like that was the easiest thing for me to believe. And at about 17 years old, I started to say, well, okay. For some reason, 18 was this, you know, definite moment. And I was becoming, you know, a grown-up, and I needed to decide for myself. And I started to question a lot of things. And my father, I think, quite wisely pointed me towards Francis Schaeffer's The God Who Is There and Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. And I started to read and engage these things. And then when I went to Bible college, I became absolutely astounded when I got into apologetics and thought this was the greatest thing ever.
Well, it obviously is. But what happened then? Because obviously that's not the end of the story. I mean, you moved presumably at some point towards Christian ministry and that kind of thing. In fact, just briefly describe where you are right now. You're actually a minister in Bolivia, of all places.
Yeah, I'm an Anglican priest, and I am licensed in the Diocese of Bolivia. And I have started with a couple of partners of mine, a ministry to help Bolivian churches start drug and alcohol rehabilitation communities. We call them transformational communities that are centered and grounded in the love of Christ. So that's where I am right now and what I'm doing.
So what kind of took you down the road to writing a book that was essentially questioning the whole project of apologetics? What sort of started to make you think maybe it wasn't such a great endeavor?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I think there's sort of two intertwining strands that of experience that kind of led me to that. One, of course, would be my own personal attempt to make sense of my faith and understand God and how I could have a viable faith for myself. And the other one would be as I studied and got into, I actually studied philosophy at university after Bible college and went on to pursue an academic career in philosophy and theology. And so as I started to read more deeply as a young person in apologetics, Francis Schaeffer was immediately one of the guys that I was reading. And he kept talking about this guy named Søren Kierkegaard, who, as he would explain him, I would be thinking, yes, yes, oh, that sounds great, yeah. And all of a sudden he'd go, and he's completely wrong for all of these reasons. I'd be like, oh, yeah, I don't get it. Yeah, he's now that makes sense. And so I was kind of caught by this and fascinated by this character. And then actually I read a book by a very good philosopher in the evangelical tradition named C. Stephen Evans, who wrote a book called The Existentialism, the Philosophy of Despair and the Quest for Hope. And he laid things out from a Kierkegaardian standpoint. And I was like, wow, I really like that. And so I decided to pursue that more. So I would think from the academic side, the study of philosophy, and in particular, as I started to try to understand what Kierkegaard was on about, is where that, you know, started me down that road. And I remember a very definitive moment when I sort of became a Kierkegaardian. That was, I had a course at university taught by an atheist philosophy professor who loved to take jabs at Christianity, and it drove me nuts, and we'd argue all the time. But he had us read a portion of Kierkegaard, and he gave a brilliant lecture on Kierkegaard's concept of the transition to faith, or sometimes called the leap of faith. And it blew me away. And so I talked to him after class, and his name was Dr. Preuss, and we went through a whole bunch of questions. And then at the end of it, I just looked at him, and I said, Dr. Preuss, why aren't you a Christian? And he looked at me just sort of blankly, and he said, because I choose not to. And I remember thinking at that point, okay, this is really what I think a Christian articulation of the world should do to people. It should bring them to the point where they just see clearly that they're exercising their will in a particular way. So that's kind of the backdrop. And then as I tried to make sense of my life and further philosophical study, I came to the point where I wrote the book.
Well, look, we'll dig into the book and the thesis behind it in more detail. I do think it's interesting, really fascinating. And as someone who has written effectively an apologetics book quite recently, I kind of wanted to say in the final chapter of that, apologetics certainly isn't the be-all and end-all. I think it does have its limitations, inevitably, and it can't do everything that some apologists would like to make out it does. Nonetheless, I run an apologetics debate show. I think there's some value in it. I think it can be used in various ways as a means to that choice that ultimately Christianity is about. But we'll get into all that, because also joining us on the line is Sean McDowell, who's a great friend of the show, and of course is son of a very famed apologist in his own right, Josh McDowell, who wrote Evidence That Demands a Verdict. I mean, how long back are we going here, Sean, when it comes to your dad writing that rather seminal book in Christian apologetics?
Oh, he wrote it 45 years ago, roughly, in 1972, the first volume.
Wow, there you go. Before you were born, I imagine. Is that the case?
That is correct. 4 years before I was born. I was born in 76.
I can rather pinpoint your age now, unfortunately. But anyway, the point is you, in a sense, you have followed somewhat in Josh's footsteps. You're obviously beating your own path as well. And I've really enjoyed the kind of debates and interactions we've had, not least, you know, over a year ago now, when I was able to join you on stage in California to have that fascinating conversation. But I suppose just talk us through first Evidence That Demands a Verdict and the story behind that before we get into the meat of today's discussion, because you've got this new revised, updated version of the book that's just come out. Substantially, though, is it the same book that it was that your dad wrote 45 years ago?
Well, his original story in writing it, he was challenged by some Christians whose lives were very appealing and attracting to them, the peace that they had to disprove Christianity. So he set out to disprove deity of Christ, the resurrection reliability of scriptures. And the evidence did not bring him to Christ. It actually got his attention, thinking, wait a minute, there's something to this story. But it's when he understood the love of Christ, drawn by the Holy Spirit, that he ended up becoming a believer. So he did all this research, started speaking on it, and everywhere he went, early 70s, there just wasn't historical apologetics like this. People were asking for his notes. So he threw his notes together and they sold like crazy. Ironically, nobody wanted the book when it first came out. And that's ironic, because now it's been like 4 million in print, and World Magazine dubbed it one of the top 100 books of the 20th century. And it's since been revised two or three times. And the last was in 1999. And so my dad and I started talking, and he asked me if I would kind of head up a research team to come out with a new edition of Evidence. And what makes Evidence unique is it's long quotes. It's not a ton of stories, although we add stories to explain and illustrate points, but it's really just a massive resource text that amazingly a lot of people have actually read through. So I worked with 36 graduate students, 12 leading scholars, people like Craig Blomberg and Mike Lacona, to research, edit, write. And we did a few things. We responded to a lot of objections from the last version of Evidence. We took out some dated material. We added some new finds, whether it's just arguments or evidence for the New Testament, the resurrection, archaeological finds. And then we just added new chapters on issues and topics that have come out since it was released in the late 90s. And really, like, the Old Testament is almost entirely new questions people are asking in the academic and even popular world.
What are some of the significant new additions then to this one? I mean, I guess when it was written, at least people generally took it for granted that Jesus existed, though today there's obviously a strong, at least on the internet, sort of Jesus mythicism movement, which of course you've come on to discuss yourself on this program before. Is that kind of covered at some level in the book?
Yeah, we added an extensive chapter on the historical evidence for Jesus within its own right, within Scripture, outside of Scripture. We had a chapter on the copycat religion, and frankly, I went through a questioning, doubting period when I first heard about Mithraism and Isis and all these early gods that allegedly were dying and rising gods. Kind of rocked my faith, and later I've learned those arguments were bad, so when we updated this, I thought, we got to have the single best, clear chapter just challenging those ideas. And then we also added the Old Testament. I think you'll find really interesting, when it was written in the 90s last, JEPD, the documentary hypothesis, was really one of the key issues. We went back and just started with historical Adam, went through the patriarchs, the Exodus, the conquest, the monarchy, the key Old Testament events and people, and just lay out the historical evidence we have that the biblical account is true.
Fascinating stuff. So this is now fully updated and available to purchase. I guess for you, even if someone has, you know, sitting on a bookshelf, that large volume that was Evidence That Demands a Verdict, this is worth their time and attention, because obviously it is effectively almost a new book in terms of all the added data, the revisions and everything else that's come about.
My best estimate is that it's about 70% new material. Wow. There's just so much that's changed in the past couple decades.
Now, it was actually yourself who first suggested perhaps that rather than do what you might expect on the back of a newly revised, updated version of that book, you know, a debate with someone who denies the resurrection or something like that. He said, well, what about a debate on the value of apologetics, full stop? Because for you, just before we get into that particular subject with Myron, obviously in your journey, Sean, apologetics has been quite important. It has definitely been part of your journey to faith and the confidence you now hold in Christ. So do you want to tell us a little bit of that journey, and maybe that'll help us segue us into how Myron responds?
Yeah, sure. Grew up in a Christian home, which is going to surprise nobody, knowing my father, who is a believer long before I came around. Unlike some of Lee Strobel's kids, he became a believer when he was already married and had kids. So I grew up hearing my father teach on this, preach on this, debate, speak, talk about it over the dinner table. And honestly, for a lot of my life, I thought people just weren't Christians because they hadn't read More Than a Carpenter or Evidence That Demands a Verdict. I remember thinking, how hard is it? And then, of course, about the age that you mentioned, Myron, about 18, 19 years old, I started really getting on the internet, reading other smart people who disagreed, and it really kind of rocked my faith. And I remember going to my dad and saying to him, honestly, we were in Breckenridge, Colorado. I said, Dad, I want to know what's true, but I don't know that I'm convinced Christianity is really true, not knowing what my apologist father would say. And he looked at me. He didn't hesitate. He goes, son, I think that's great. And it kind of took me by surprise. He said, I've raised you to follow and seek truth wherever it leads. He goes, I sense you want to know truth. If you really seek it, I'm confident you'll be led to it. And he said, you know, don't reject something just because you don't like it. Only reject something if ultimately it's not true. And then he said, your mom and I will love you no matter what. And I don't think I stopped believing. And I don't want to overstate the evidence, but it was – I had emotional doubts, I had relational doubts, but finding some additional reasons to take Christianity as true did give me some confidence, and ultimately is a part of my story, coming to faith and ultimately becoming an apologist.
There are links to both my guests on today's show. If you want to go online, check it out. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is the place to go. You can find links to the new edition of Evidence That Demands a Verdict, and of course Myron B. Penner's book, which is The End of Apologetics, Christian Witness in a Postmodern Context. And if you want to get in touch about today's show, perhaps leave your thoughts, whether you're an apologist or not, or something else altogether, do tell me what you think of today's show topic as we ask, is apologetics a dead end? unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address to send your thoughts in. You can also, of course, leave them via our social media at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. All those links and more available, along with today's show and loads of other stuff, at the Unbelievable website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So today on the show, I'm joined by Sean McDowell and Myron B. Penner. Sean is a co-author now with his father, Josh, of the newly updated version of Evidence That Demands a Verdict. But we're kind of questioning the whole apologetic enterprise today on Unbelievable. To do that, Myron B. Penner is on the line as well. He's a church leader out in Bolivia, has kindly been able to come on the line to talk about his book, The End of Apologetics, Christian Witness in a Postmodern Context. We kind of got to the point where, for some reason, Kierkegaard had sort of made you decide that you had to completely reassess the way you sort of approached the way you, I suppose, the epistemology of your Christian faith, how you know things. What was it specifically that made you ultimately come to the view that the rational defense, using evidence, argumentation, and so on, as a way of discerning the truth of Christianity, is a flawed enterprise? If that's a good summary of where you find yourself, Myron.
Yeah, no, actually, I think you've done an amazing job of summarizing the book that I wrote. I have been on other shows where it was not as well summarized. So thank you for that. You did it. I mean, honestly, you hit really the nub of what I'm about. And in response to your question, I think for me, what astounded me when I got into Kierkegaard was his concept. He calls it the essentially Christian, but really what he's talking about is that what really makes Christianity, what really Christianity is that it's a way of being in the truth. It's not a set of abstract, objective truths about God or the world or Jesus Christ. And so I can distinctly remember reading a journal entry that he wrote when he was just a little bit older than I was at the time, where he said, "What does it matter to me if truth stood cold and naked before me, not caring whether I believed her or not?" And he said, "What I lack is a truth for which I can live and die." And I remember thinking, okay, well, that sounds like Jesus saying that I am the way, the truth, and the life. And so for me, it was that deep resonance that Kierkegaard's idea had with something that had always stuck with me as I was engaging in apologetic classes and research and papers and stuff, was that Jesus says that he is the way, the truth, and the life. And this idea that, well, actually being a Christian is not about believing certain propositional truths about God or Jesus Christ. As, of course, St. James says, the demons believe there is one. You believe there's one God, that's great. You believe there's one God, that's awesome. The demons believe that too, but that doesn't make them a Christian. And so this idea that Christianity is a way of being in the truth, not acquiring a sort of cognitively pristine set of truths that you can give intellectual assent to. Okay.
But having said all that, and I can see where you're coming from with that, Myron, there's that whole thing of, you know, well, look, is it not legitimate to require some level of credibility to the gospel accounts that, you know, this stuff really did happen? There was a man, Jesus. And is there anything wrong with saying, look, when you put the evidence together, there's a lot of stuff that seems to stack up in favor of a man really did come back from the dead and so on? I mean, and I can understand why that would be so attractive as well to Christians whose atheist skeptical friends are saying, come on, if this is really true, there must be some kind of evidence behind it as well. So are you completely discounting that kind of level at which apologetics functions?
Oh, no, absolutely not. And this is when I think the critical mistakes that people make when they try to understand what I'm talking about. I'm not saying there's no evidences. I think sometimes the evidences don't point the direction that people think they do. But that's an academic question. My real core concern here is the whole Enlightenment project of establishing rational foundations for Christian belief. That's the sort of apologetics that I'm against. So I think there are a whole host of things that one can point out. My big problem is the place from which that question comes. The fundamental question is not a correct set of beliefs, but a personal relationship with God and Jesus Christ, and of course, partnership in the community of believers, the church. That's really what the core thing is. And the spiritual problem of modern people is not a correct set of beliefs. It's a way of living so that they can be free from despair, which is what they lack. Getting more correct beliefs doesn't change that. So my problem is one of orientation more than whether or not a specific evidence points this way or that way. For me, it's making that question the question on which faith hinges. For me, faith is not fundamentally about whether or not I have the correct set of beliefs. I absolutely believe, as you mentioned, that yes, there are things that need to be credible. There is nonsense in the world. You can't believe what is nonsense and passionately believe it and somehow have faith in it and make it true for you. That's absolutely not what I'm talking about.
Where do you tie into this then, Sean? Because I think you can probably see a lot of truth and value in what Myron's saying. I just wonder whether you take it quite as far as he does in terms of where he ends up on that.
Yeah, I read your book, Myron, and I enjoyed it immensely. I actually read it twice. I bought a hard copy, left it at my sister-in-law's, and then bought a digital copy on Kindle. So you owe me. But I enjoyed it.
I have a couple of copies of your dad's book too.
All right, perfect. We're even then. I guess I would differ over a couple things. As I read it, it felt to me, and you can come back and correct me if I'm wrong, that you were saying the primary task of an apologist is just about establishing certain propositions in themselves as being true. So a minute ago, you said being a Christian is not about believing certain propositions. And I would agree 100% that being Christian is not just about believing certain propositions. And then I believe you said faith, I'm sorry, you described how it's being in a relationship with Jesus and with the church. I guess my difference is I would say it's both. We are called scripturally to have right beliefs in terms of orthodoxy, and we're called scripturally to act out that. And every apologist I know that is influential doesn't do apologetics just to win arguments in the abstract, just to establish certain propositions. It is for the loving advance of the gospel to set people free with the truth of what Jesus brings. So if you look at 1 John, he gives a few tests for being an authentic Christian. And one is exactly what you said. He says in 1:6, if we say we have fellowship with him while we walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. So if we're not practicing this, then we're lying. These truths are meant to be lived out. I agree 100%. But then in 2:22, John also says, who is the liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? This is the Antichrist. He who denies the Father and the Son. So now he's saying it's not only correct obedience and correct practice, as you're indicating, but it's also correct belief. And I think this would play itself out in how I would see faith. So I don't think faith is fundamentally just about right beliefs. And in fact, even people like J.P. Moreland, who I know you differ with in your book, would say faith is not about right beliefs. It's trusting in God in light of what we have reason to believe is true. So I would say Christianity is about orthodoxy and it's about orthopraxy. But I agree with you. If we just have orthodoxy and don't put into practice, what's the point?
Do you want a quick response and then we'll go to a break?
Yeah. See, we're almost there, Sean. I'm with you, except for that quote from J.P. Moreland, because it's the last part of that, the condition. It's what we trust in Jesus Christ based on what we can reasonably believe. That's not what we're asked. That's not what the apostles asked anyone. They did testify that they knew they saw Jesus raised from the dead, but they didn't provide evidences for it in that way. They announced, here's what God says. And that's why a core, as I'm sure you know, because you've read the book, one of the core analogies that I use is that the model for apologetics should be the apostle, not the genius, because we're not trying to be clever. We're trying to announce with the power of the Spirit, the gospel, the good news, that Jesus is in fact the one. So yes, you have to believe in Jesus, but it's not believe that Jesus. And I know you're aware of that distinction, but it's believe in Jesus.
I'm going to just go to a break and we will continue this conversation. We're talking about the value and methodology, really, of apologetics today. Is apologetics a dead end? We're asking. My guests are Sean McDowell and Myron B. Penner here on Unbelievable, which is, from week to week, an apologetics discussion and debate show. So it's an interesting question to ask, isn't it, really? So we'll be back with my two guests in just a moment's time. We're on air with broadcasting legend Jeremy Vine in the latest Premier Christianity magazine, as he tells us how he lost his faith and then found it again, and life behind the mic on his radio and TV programmes. Plus, we profile three of the UK's fastest growing churches as they share their secrets on why their congregations are multiplying members. And as 2018 begins, read about five spiritual practices that could renew your relationship with God in the new year. All that plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists. Ask for a free copy of the January edition, premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Justin Briley, and here on Unbelievable, we bring you interesting conversations every week, and we'll be getting back into our discussion between my guests Myron B. Penner and Sean McDowell in just a moment's time. Later on Unbelievable, I'm pleased to say I'm going to be joined by another guest. That is Jeremiah J. Johnston, who is a head of the Christian Thinkers Society. He's been on the programme before, and he's got a new book out called unimaginable. What the world would be like without Christianity. I'll be talking to him about that towards the end of today's programme. So do stick around for that. And don't forget that straight after today's programme, you can hear The Profile between 4 and 5. I'll be joined at the beginning of that by Bruxy Cavey, pastor from the Meeting House out in Toronto, Canada. He sat down with me to talk about his faith life, ministry and his new book. You can also find that as a podcast in its own right. We're asking today on the show, is apologetics a dead end? Sean McDowell and Myron B. Penner join me here on Unbelievable, debating the methodology and value of apologetics. What is that? It's not about saying sorry for something. Apologetics, if you were to give it a definition, might be the rational defense of the Christian faith through argumentation and evidence. It does happen a lot on this show, as we have Christian and non-Christian dialogues from week to week. But today, two Christians join me to just look at the whole prospect, the whole endeavor of apologetics, and whether we've got it right when it comes to the books that we enjoy reading on this front. Josh McDowell, the father of Sean, was responsible for a classic in Christian apologetics, his evidential book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Myron B. Penner, though, church leader out in Bolivia, joining us on Skype along with Sean today, says, I'm just not sure that we've kind of really got to the heart of this. The End of Apologetics, his book, argues that we've really been held hostage to a sort of the ground upon which modernism has been built, the modernist enterprise, and that actually Christianity was never meant to be about believing a set of propositions. It's about something you trust in. It's I suppose, in that sense, an experiential, more of a subjective experience. Just to clarify that, Myron, you're not saying you're against evidence per se, but it's about what you build your faith on, I suppose. And I have heard others, not least people who you might call, say, a part of what is often called technically presuppositional apologetics, who key into this and say, I'm not going to go down the base my faith on the cosmological argument or something like that, because who knows what might change in terms of the scientific evidence tomorrow. It has to be something that's much more just I'm presupposing that the Bible is true, that Jesus rose from the dead. That this is the kind of way that some people go. Now, it doesn't sound that that's quite what you're saying with your book. You're not. I don't have you down as a presuppositional apologist, or indeed a fideist. You know, someone who just says you just have to believe and sort of, you know, it's there's nothing to do with the rational, intellectual element of our personality involved. So what are you saying? Well, I mean, in what sense can you even arrive at belief or trusting in Christ without some sort of propositional aspect to it, you know, that you're being presented with things to believe in that sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, the big issue is trying to set up the problem and setting up the problem the way the sort of modern Enlightenment project wants to set it up, in terms of, well, let's figure out what's the cleverest system or the most airtight logical system. And this is where actually one of the statements that C.S. Lewis made really early on, and that I read really early on in my, search from Mere Christianity, where I remember reading where he says, you know, I think it's about the belief in, it might be the resurrection or belief in the Trinity, that it's not the result of a debate about the most philosophically cogent way to think about the world. It's a response to the risen Christ that you encounter. And so for me, the spiritual problem of modernity is not that it lacks evidence or information. It's that it's in despair, that it lacks the resources to live meaningful lives. And it does that because it's cut itself off from that ground. And so the answer to this problem is not clever arguments. Although clever arguments can, and at certain contexts, should be made, but the answer is faithful witness, and in particular, a transformative community, the church that displays the faithfulness and the truthfulness of God to the quality of its life together, which will include, of course, an intellectually robust account of the world and of God. So I want to reframe apologetics in terms of witness, because I think we've drifted away from it to becoming the specialist thing that geniuses do. But for me, the paradigmatic witness or the model of a witness that I take to be the best one is the one who suffers and dies for her belief, not the one who mounts a rationally coercive argument or can marshal all the evidence.
From your point of view, Sean, I'm sure you'd agree that if to bring people to the point of conversion requires getting a PhD in biblical criticism, then obviously no one's, not very few people are going to be one. Given what Myron has said there, where does the distinction lie? I mean, I get the feeling maybe you think Myron's got a bit of a false dichotomy going on here between this idea of witness and this kind of intellectual project of apologetics, which is, it has become the province of very brainy people, basically. How do you square these two?
Yeah, a moment ago, Myron made a distinction. He writes this in his book, kind of between an apologist and an apostle. And I think he's right. I think we should follow what the apostles do. But if we go to Acts and we look at the apostle Paul, for example, what does it say in Acts 17, 2 through 4? As was his custom, he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving it was necessary. And it says some of them were persuaded. In Corinth, in Acts 18, he reasoned the synagogue with Jews and with Greeks. In Acts 19, reasoning and persuading them. So we should follow an apostolic model. And if we do, we find that they didn't just reason. They told stories. They built relationships with people. They served the poor. But reason was one piece and component of it. And I find it interesting that he said, the best apologetic is witness. I did my dissertation on the deaths of the apostles and their willingness to go to the graves for their belief that Jesus had risen from the grave. And we would need to parse out some of the facts behind that. But overall, I think he's right. But it's not just in the present. Go back to the apostles themselves, and we actually find that they died for this belief. And this is one component of showing they weren't liars, didn't make up the resurrection story. They actually believed it. And that's why I think Jesus, it says in John 20, 30 through 31, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So John is about the recording of supernatural signs, miracles, and arguments that Jesus made that give us a basis for belief, not the only basis, but a basis for belief. And then we're supposed to believe in Jesus and experience life in his name. So I think that's where we differ a little. I think it's interesting. You quote C.S. Lewis a good amount in your book. C.S. Lewis did believe that doctrine was a response to your experience with God. But his journey to faith specifically involved part of it examining the evidence, looking at the evidence for the resurrection. And he actually said, quote, nearly everyone I know who has embraced Christianity in adult life has been influenced by what seemed to him at least probable arguments for theism. So I don't want to overstate the role of evidence. Please don't hear me saying that. But I fear that we're understating it on the flip side. There's a balance that we need to keep.
And what do you say to the fact there, Myron, as Sean indicates, that it looks on the face of it like the apostles, like Paul, were doing effectively apologetics in their day and time, you know, when they reasoned from the scriptures, you know, when he's at the Areopagus talking with the philosophers there. I mean, something like apologetics is happening.
Right. And there has to be a very nuanced conversation about that. And I'm not sure that we can get into it right now. But the critical pivot for me is modernity. And what's happening apologetically in Paul's case just simply is not anything like modern apologetics. And I would like to add that on the just the bald face of it, the kind of evidence, marshalling of evidence that Sean and his dad present was almost sort of unadorned. It is not the direct target of my book either. I don't think I mentioned, I know for a fact, I don't mention the McDowells once. And part of that is for that very reason. Because I'm talking about a project that says what that person over there who doesn't believe in, who's got, like, let's say, Christopher Hitchens, because he's no longer with us and we can't offend him. You know, Christopher Hitchens' problem is that he believes that Christianity is false for a whole bunch of bad arguments, because he has a whole bunch of bad arguments. And I would just say that that's not Christopher Hitchens' problem. The way to get him to encounter the love of God in Jesus Christ is not going to be first and foremost having an argument with him. There might be a time and a place for that, but the project that makes that the center of what we should be doing, it just simply isn't it. And I mean, Paul is absolutely, utterly clear that he came to them not with power, but in weakness. And he resolved to know nothing among the Corinthians except the power of the cross, Christ crucified, that this is something that the Greeks stumble on. I mean, so to simply say that, oh, he used arguments and evidence somehow falsifies my thesis. Well, I'm just simply not talking about that. I'm talking about something completely different.
I mean, you mentioned Christopher Hitchens there, and obviously he was involved in many an apologetic debate with significant individuals. What was interesting about that, though, is that you kind of got the impression sometimes that Christopher Hitchens just didn't like the concept of God, full stop. And, you know, you could have been there arguing till kingdom come, and he would always have another argument to reach for to and so on. So I kind of understand where you're coming from, Myron, that some people aren't going to be won by an argument. I suppose the question is then, in that instance, something else has to happen. It's got to be another of those avenues. But does that discount altogether the project? Because there may be other people for whom, as it was for Sean and for many others who I know, where having those conversations, those arguments, help to at least remove some roadblocks, let's say. The way I've often put it myself, and in fact the way I put it in my book, is that I often think that of apologetics more as removing certain intellectual roadblocks to allow people to walk down that path towards faith in Jesus Christ. But it's not going to force them to walk down the path. In a sense, it might help them to understand why God might allow suffering, if that's the thing that's stopping them taking that journey. Or it might show them that there is enough historical evidence for Jesus to take the gospel seriously. It's more about giving permission to people to take that leap of faith, as Kierkegaard put it, that I think right. is inevitably there. Is that enough of a justification for apologetics, in your view?
Well, I mean, I think there's apologetics and there's apologetics, but I would just like to sort of use the analogy that you use, which I think is great. Definitely what you're classifying as apologetic conversations or arguments or discussions will happen as we walk down the path with someone, let's say, as you, I think, mentioned, somebody who's suffering bereavement. Mm. But for me, let's focus on the walking down the path with them, not the quality of our arguments, because the quality of our witness will not depend on the quality of our arguments. The quality of our arguments is always a good thing. But for me, I want to situate that in a context of a relationship to, and this is why I'm quite careful to make sure we focus on the person in my book, right? Because that's going to be the thing that people, they encounter Jesus Christ in me, not in my arguments. And if they don't encounter Jesus Christ in me, it doesn't matter how much I argue. And if they do encounter Jesus Christ in me, then even if my arguments are not going to pass muster in a philosophy department, it's not going to matter. We need to have an intellectual witness as well. But it's the walking down the path that I want to emphasize, and being willing to face the tough questions and all the stuff that I've heard Sean say today, you know, being willing to have those conversations openly and honestly. And I love what he told me, his story about his dad, about, hey, listen, let's pursue the truth. And we believe that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. So, you know, let's go for that whole hog, as you will, and ask all the tough questions and not give the easy answers. So,
sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, that's certainly what we aim to do on Unbelievable, is genuinely have that kind of a dialogue. It's not pat answers apologetics in that sense. It's a genuine kind of we're going to wrestle with these issues, and sometimes some shows are, you know, sort of set up a little bit in the dynamic of who's going to win this argument intellectually. But I'm fully aware that that's not the way people come to faith ultimately. It might be helpful, sort of all of this stuff kind of counts at some level in terms of the directions people go, but I guess I've never seen apologetics as ultimately what brings people to faith. I still think that is a work of the Holy Spirit in a way that is to some extent beyond our comprehension. But Sean, I'm because I'm really interested in this, I'm doing too much of the talking here. So Sean, take over. Where do you land on some of the stuff Myron's been talking about?
I think we definitely have some common ground on the importance of walking down path with people in their pain, in their suffering, in their life. I saw Jesus do this. I see Paul doing this. I think maybe I just would quibble a little bit when he said, let's focus on walking down the path, not arguments. In my experience with a lot of people, arguments and evidences and reason to even go down this path is important to them. I had a fellow sit down with me, a brilliant stockbroker, just did wonderful in school. And he looked at me and he just said, you know, he had a friend who went through suffering, which is a part of his path. And he said, I'm scientific minded. Can you give me any evidence that God actually exists? Pulled out a napkin. We were at a coffee shop and I walked through the cosmological argument, fine tuning. He goes, okay, how do we know the Bible's true? And I said, well, here's my best answers. We looked at manuscripts and internal testimony, et cetera. He goes, well, how do you know Jesus is the only way? What about evil? How do you know Jesus is God? we walk through this. So part of his journey, and it's not everybody's journey, it's certainly not, is using arguments and reason with people. So I just think we need to be ready with an answer when people ask us those tough questions. So I think you and I are talking past each other a little bit, Myron, in the sense of you're critiquing a certain kind of modern apologetics tied to a certain epistemology. Yes. One of my questions, it wasn't always clear to me in the book when you were critiquing modern apologetics. It seemed to throw all of apologetics in there, and maybe I just missed it. So you told this story that I thought was compelling about a friend of yours named John and two young seminarians who had just taken an apologetics class with William Lane Craig, and specifically, this guy is on his journey and they're just arguing against him in a way that when I heard you tell that story, this guy, John, was so turned off by it, not a believer. I'm sitting there going, yeah, I cringe just as much as you do. And I know for 100% sure that William Lane Craig would cringe and doesn't teach people to do that. I've made those mistakes in my life. I could tell stories the next hour of times I've blown it. So sometimes it felt like these stories, which in your book you do a wonderful job of just pushing back on apologetics, it felt to me you were highlighting an abuse of apologetics, but not necessarily its proper use. So I'd love to know what that proper use is to you.
Right, and that's a good question. And I think there's definitely a legitimate point to be made that you just made, that often in the book I'm talking one-sidedly on one side of the issue, and fair enough. I'll take that. But I think the point still stands. I don't want to get in too much into that story because I don't want to start throwing stones at people. But I would argue that it's the epistemological orientation of the kind of apologetics that these young guys were taught that made it, that gave them the intellectual permission, not the spiritual permission, but the intellectual permission, because of how they wanted to frame the issues that were most important in John's life, which is not his real name, by the way, that's what caused them to go down that road. And by the way, they were quoting Bill Craig as supporting their activity, which I understand that Bill would cringe, and he is not about that kind of, you know, sort of intellectual attack. So I think to answer your question more directly that you asked about, well, what would be the context? For me, it's in the context of a personal relationship, as I said before. As we seek to love the other person, then there will be moments in which we have to articulate clearly why it is that we believe in Jesus Christ. And I think it's the task of the church to have an intellectually cogent articulation of the Christian worldview. I actually don't like the definitive article there, but you know how Christians see the world and what the world looks like from a Christian perspective. And for me, that's the part that the arguments for God's existence play. That's certainly how I think St. Thomas Aquinas sees them play.
In another interview, I'll let you come back in a moment, Sean, but you said this, Myron, I am against apologetics insofar as it suggests explicitly or implicitly that what makes Christianity believable or worthy of our belief is that it is somehow grounded in human rational capabilities. So that somehow it's kind of as far as we can make rational sense of Christianity in a kind of objective, modernistic sort of way that we might treat, I don't know, science or other aspects of our knowledge. As long as we're treating it like that, we've got hold of the wrong end of the stick, as it were, because that makes it about our ability, I suppose. Now, does this kind of, is this because for you that means then that it's no longer about God's grace and that sort of revelation of God? It suddenly becomes all about how well we can intellectually grasp the, you know, the arguments and evidence and that kind of thing, if that's actually what we're basing our beliefs on about Christianity.
Absolutely. And there's a philosophical mistake there, I think, as well as a theological one. The idea that somehow God has to somehow come to us in a way that we find acceptable and rational is just, I think, theologically repugnant. I think the temptation that Christians have is to think that because there are intelligible reasons for faith within the Christian tradition, that this can somehow be a substitute for our reliance on God and our need to hear from him. And I think philosophically, it just simply is wrong as well. It overestimates the capacity of our rational abilities to ground truth. It's reductive, and in the end, I think it's self-defeating and unhelpful.
I'm inclined to agree to the extent that I have definitely seen apologists who were so, what is it? Is it the right side of our brain that's the analytical, logical side? Who kind of almost set apologetics up as the way in which I'm going to know about God, and therefore it all becomes, yes, a sort of an intellectual endeavor. And the problem with that is that you do turn apologetics itself into an idol, into something where it was never supposed to occupy that kind of very experiential aspect and the reliance on God rather than on our own intellect for knowing things about God. To the extent that I would say, you know, I think there are better witnesses to Christ in the form of a 5-year-old child saying their prayers than the most lofty apologist who has the most devastating intellectual arguments. But for some reason, it just doesn't get through to the person who just sees someone who's good at, you know, making arguments in that sense. I don't know if I'm sort of expressing anything of what you feel in the book there, Myron.
No, absolutely. And I think that's exactly where, you know, I'm going with that. I'd like to point out, you know, in the quote that you gave, and I'm very careful in the book to do this, it was insofar as, and that's, I think, the sort of out that I'll give myself in response to Sean's earlier question, where, yes, I am talking about very one-sidedly about the issue, but I'm trying to make a corrective, so I'm not going to be completely fair about it. But, you know, in proportion to, you know, as much as we make that the thing that we're grounding it in, then we're wrong. And some people in some contexts won't do that, and they'll make, you know, intelligent reasons why this objection is not a good one or whatever. And it's a red herring to think that faith somehow is derailed because the cosmological argument fails or whatever. Yeah, sure, fine. In the context of a moment in a relationship with a person who's really struggling intellectually with what it means to have faith, you know, then we definitely intellectually engage them.
Well, just coming back to you, Sean, on this. I guess you're sympathetic to the criticism that when apologetics does become about, I guess, moving intellectual counters around, about our trusting more, in a sense, in our intellectual ability than in the God who gave us those abilities to reveal himself and to be present in situations, then obviously that's a danger. But I don't think you're denying any of that in the way you would present and want people to do apologetics if they're going to do it.
Oh, I agree 100% that arguments can be a substitute for reliance on God, and they shouldn't. My father and I say in the updated evidence, and I say regularly, that our faith is in God, not in the arguments or even in people. So again, when apologists do this, this is an abuse of apologetics, not the proper biblical role of how we're supposed to do apologetics. And I think it's maybe a little bit ironic because the person who's kind of your foil in the book, William Lane Craig, goes out of his way to say he doesn't ground his faith in the evidence. He talks about knowing it directly by the Holy Spirit. So he's actually said in Reasonable Faith, if the argument for the resurrection failed, if the cosmological argument failed, all that would show is we couldn't demonstrate its truth. It wouldn't mean that it's false. Now, if I could jump back to something before, I might see it a little differently than you did, Myron, about that story with John. You kind of felt like it's the nature of apologetics and its orientation that caused these two men to treat that non-believer John a certain way. I could tell you stories about how postmoderns and emergent people have written blogs about me, treated me with an elitism, with a know-it-all, that they're enlightened. And I think you could make the same case that there's something about that postmodern turn that looks with denigration at modernism. Now, I don't actually think that's inherent to postmodernism, but I think it no more undermines the case for apologetics than the abuse of when people talk about postmodernism undermines the potential truth of postmodernism.
I suppose I should say fair enough. I do actually address that kind of issue quite briefly, but definitely in the book, about making this into another idol itself. You know, you set up the sort of the anti-method model. I mean, idol to replace the method idol that you have with modernity. And yeah, my point is in regard to, well, let me say it this way. Our epistemologies will orient us towards different kinds of idolatries. It doesn't matter, you know, who you are as a human being or what your particular intellectual system is or orientation is, you will be oriented towards idolatry. So yes, none of us escape that. I'm just highlighting one particular way, and it's a serious blind spot.
Yeah,
I think.
I think it is anything is important to we can get so enthusiastic about the apologetic enterprise that we are often blind to the weaknesses as well, and the ways in which we kind of treat it in ways that it was never meant to be used. Going to go to a quick break, and then we'll have final thoughts from both my guests on Unbelievable today, having one of those meta discussions where we're talking about the things we actually do on this show from week to week. We often have apologetic discussion and debate, but does it ever actually win people? And have we kind of been barking up the wrong epistemological tree all this time? Those are the kinds of issues we're debating on the show today. Sean McDowell and Myron B. Penner join me here on the show that aims to get you thinking every week.
Hello and welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading sceptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's Unbelievable, the last Unbelievable of 2017 before we launch into a new year. Lots of good things on the horizon from the show that brings lots of different voices together for dialogue and debate. And I do like to tell you about what others are doing as well. So towards the end of today's programme, I'm going to be speaking to Jeremiah J. Johnston about his new book, Unimaginable. Listen out for that towards the end of today's programme. Straight after Unbelievable, you can hear The Profile. Bruxy Cavey is one of my guests on the show this week. You can hear his story as a pastor out in Canada at the Meeting House and about his new book, which is called Reunion. If you come back again at the same time next week, we're going to be doing apologetics, proper apologetics, rather than debating the nature of apologetics. Meter Street Epistemologist is our subject next week. Pasco Rapace is a street epistemologist. Not sure what that is. You shall find out. And Cameron Bertuzzi will be our Christian guest discussing the whole project of street epistemology, which is effectively a sort of an atheist form of evangelism, with Pasco on next week's programme. So looking forward to that conversation at the same time next week. If you want to get in touch with today's show, don't forget you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and then you get in touch via the Facebook at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for Facebook.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Really interesting discussion today on whether apologetics is a dead end. Sean McDowell, who with his father Josh McDowell has produced an updated version of the classic book Evidence That Demands a Verdict. There'll be a link, of course, from today's show. He's on the line talking with Myron B. Penner, church leader out in Bolivia. He's joined us by Skype, actually, from Bolivia today. And he wrote a book a few years ago called The End of Apologetics, Christian Witness in a Postmodern Context, and described at the beginning of today's programme how he started out as a great advocate of apologetics, but kind of became, to some extent, disillusioned. I think that's actually a common trait I see in many people, Myron, people who kind of get so enthusiastic about apologetics, thinks it's going to answer all their friends' questions. And when, even though it seems so obvious to the individual who's holding that point of view, but still their friends refuse Christian faith, they suddenly kind of think, oh, well, that didn't work then. I don't know. I sometimes feel like people abandon the project because it didn't give them the results that it was supposed to or that it promised to. Whereas, Sean, I get from your perspective that you're fully signed up to the fact that, no, of course not everyone's going to see the arguments the way you see them. There's a lot of other factors, I suppose, going on in anybody's journey towards or away from Christian faith than just the arguments and what we think might be a good argument for Jesus or for God. Do you want to talk about that a bit, Sean, as we start to close out the show?
Sure, yeah. I'm concerned if we understate the value of evidence, because I work with high school students and college students, and I get questions all the time. Now, I'm also concerned if we overstate the value of the evidence. I think the best place to go is Scripture. Now, Myron, I think you'll gently push back and say we got to be careful looking at the apologetics in the Bible as opposed to modernity. And that is fair enough. I think we should take our cues from the Scripture. And if we do, we see that Jesus was a kind of apologist. He advanced certain arguments. He actually used very sophisticated reasoning. Now, he did so much more than that. He told stories. He healed people. He built relationships. But he was a kind of apologist. Paul was. The early church fathers were. So given where we're at in culture, I just think a biblical apologetic is one of the most important things that we need to do. In fact, I interviewed Lee Strobel not long ago, and I asked him, I said, there's all this talk kind of about postmodernism. Do you think that's true? How does this relate to the project you're doing? And he looked at me and chuckled. He said, when he was writing Case for Christ originally, now this is late 90s, he said, I was told by a prominent theologian that my book's not going to work. People aren't interested in evidence. They don't care about apologetics. I went home to my wife and said it was going to be a failure. Well, of course, that theologian could not have been more wrong, because Lee actually told me, he said, it's actually more young people have come to him and become believers through his books and now his movies than anything else. So I just don't want to lose the role of this. I want to see us do it better. I think what you're calling us to in your book, Myron, which is a point well taken, is we need to be consistent. We need to be humble. We need to adopt means that also match the message and are biblical. We need to not buy into this capitalist mindset. You have a chapter on this and just write books to make money or power or all the other things that are trappings that follow it. But if your book is a callback to that, even though we're going to disagree on some particulars, I say amen. Let's do it with consistency. Let's do it biblically. Let's do it humble, because there's a lot of non-believers who do have genuine questions and Christians who need to have answers to their tough questions.
Myron, any final thoughts as we close out today's show?
Well, I mean, I guess my dominant thought here is that if that's where Sean's at, then I'm okay with Sean. No, that's great. I love how you wrap that up. Like you said, we will have disagreements, but I'm extremely concerned that we keep Jesus Christ at the center and the power. I mean, when Paul says he's not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, he means the gospel of Jesus Christ. And for him, Jesus is the gospel. And, you know, he's not saying, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ because it's intellectually satisfying. It can solve, you know, all the intellectual problems in the universe. It's the most coherent way to think. No, it's because it's the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, first Jew and then the Gentile. And so that's where I'm at. That's my core concern in writing the book. As I've articulated here on this program, you know, my concern is that we shift and lose sight of what the gospel is really all about. And it's about God reaching us, not about us reaching God.
Do you think a lot of Christians are simply wasting their energy if they're engaged in some endless debate on a Facebook page with a hardened atheist?
Thinking
that ultimately the power of their final argument, you know, will win them over somehow.
Absolutely. And even if you do win them over, you have the danger of making them twice the son of hell that you are, as Jesus might say. In other words, you have the danger of winning them over to a set of beliefs instead of to a person, the person of Jesus Christ. So that's my concern.
Sean, any final thoughts as we close out?
Good discussion. I appreciate you coming on and sharing. And I think your point about every single worldview can have its idolatry is important to keep in mind for apologists. In fact, one of the things my father and I put at the beginning of apologetics is of the updated evidence is why apologetics has a bad name. And we start off by saying apologists often overstate their case. We don't speak with gentleness and kindness. Oftentimes, apologists are not emotionally healthy. Oftentimes, apologetics is done in a cold, mechanical, rational manner. And oftentimes, apologists are intellectually elitist. So I'm convinced more than ever, looking at culture, working with young people, that they have real questions today. And apologetics is one critical task of the church. But let's do it the way Jesus did. Let's do it with kindness. Let's do it with generosity. And ultimately, let the truth speak for itself.
Well, you both get an amen from me in many ways. So thank you both for such a spirited and good-natured discussion as well on this whole area. It's been very helpful, actually, for me to tease out some of these different aspects of this whole thing. If you enjoyed today's show, I'm sure you're going to enjoy both of the books that we've been talking about today. The Evidence That Demands a Verdict, the newly updated version of that, available now from Sean and Josh McDowell. Myron B. Penner's book, The End of Apologetics, also worthy of your time and attention. Both of those are available from today's programme. If you want to go and listen back, share it on with others, or indeed look into the vast back catalogue of debates and discussions here on the show, go to the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. For the moment, Sean and Myron, thank you both for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Yes, do get in touch if you'd like to feedback on today's subject. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the way to do that via email. And as usual, you can find us on Facebook, on Twitter. Just search for The Unbelievable Show. Or indeed, go to today's programme at the website and leave a comment there. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Just before we go to my interview with Jeremiah J. Johnston, who's going to be joining us on the line to talk about Unimaginable, a quick shout out for Premier Christianity magazine. If you're not a subscriber, can I recommend you start subscribing for 2018? Got some really great content coming up in future editions of the magazine. And the January magazine is available now. And on the front cover is my interview with UK broadcasting legend Jeremy Vine, talking about his faith. Now, you will hear that in a future edition of The Profile as well, but it's worth reading it in the magazine. And you'll see behind the scenes at Radio 2, where he does his daily radio show, and find out more about his life and faith. Really interesting, revealing interview as he talked about why he lost his faith and how he won it back again. So if you want to find the free sample copy, get it delivered to your door of the January edition, premierchristianity.com/free sample. is the place to go. Just wanted to make time as well to give a quick shout out to Ed Atkinson, who's one of the organisers of the Unbelievable Skeptics and Christians Discussion Group that meets regularly in London. Their next gathering is going to be Monday, the 8th of January at 7:30 p.m. at the usual King's Cross pub location, that Somerstown Coffee House. And it's on the subject, A Prosecution Lawyer Talks About Witnesses and Evidence. This time it's an atheist, Francis Janusz, who's going to be giving the talk. And as usual, there'll be discussion between the Christians and atheists who gather there for that that regular group. Again, Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group London is what you're looking for, at the meetup.com website for more details. Happening on Monday, the 8th of January at 7:30 p.m. Well, it's a great pleasure to be joined now on the show by Jeremiah J. Johnston. He's a New Testament scholar, and he also heads up the Christian Thinker Society. He's the president of that organization, and they've partnered with us the last couple of years on our Unbelievable conference. He's a friend of the show, so it's great to have him on the line to tell us about a new book that's just been released, Unimaginable: What Our World Would Be Like Without Christianity. Jeremiah, welcome along to the program.
Justin, it's always great to talk to you. You are a scholar. You're a dear friend. I appreciate all you're doing for the kingdom, my friend.
Well, I appreciate all that you're doing. And you're as ever, a man it's difficult to pin down, because you've got books coming out, you've got tours going on, you've got all kinds of stuff. And I do note that books with the title Un at the beginning are very popular these days. Because your last
one... We're totally on trend.
Completely. Because Unanswered was your last one. Unimaginable now, and of course, there's my Unbelievable book. But
wife called my book Unbelievable the other day.
There you go. It's a Freudian slip, obviously.
That's right.
No, it's really fun. And I was really glad also to give a brief endorsement for this book as well. You let me see an early draft of it back in the summer. And I just really liked the concept of the book, Unimaginable, because what you kind of explain how it was actually from that Amazon series, TV series, The Man in the High Castle, that the genesis of this idea came to you, a hypothetical of what our world might look like if such and such had never happened or had happened. Take us back to where this book started, Jeremiah.
Yeah, you know, and it turns out it's a really fun way to teach. I'm a university professor, and guess what? It is an excellent way to read a book and assimilate new information. My wife and I were watching this show, Man in the High Castle, and I travel about 40 weeks a year, so when I'm home, we binge watch shows, Justin. And this show essentially looks at what would have happened to the world had the Axis powers had won World War II. specifically what would have happened in the United States. And it's a dystopic, very dark world. And in between the shows, I would just make mention to my wife, Audrey, of just ways in which the Jesus movement utterly transformed Western civilization, so much so that, you know, Hitler, when Churchill stood against him, Churchill said that he had indeed thought that God had raised him up to protect Western Christian civilization. Now, why is that? And just sharing this with my wife, she said, Jerry, she said, you've got to write a book, kind of using this alternative virtual history, these factual alternatives of what would it have been like had this not occurred. And so we do it really in three ways, Justin: the world before Christianity, the world without Christianity, which we don't really need to imagine what that world would be like, and then we need to look at the world with Christianity. And so the big idea of the book is to explore what the world would have been like, A, had Christianity not emerged, and then what will happen to the world if Christianity collapses. But I also wanted to magnify how our shared faith has blessed the world to a degree that, listen closely, even if you are a person of no faith at all, the everyday conveniences and the most of the rights that you and I now enjoy would not exist without God working in the influence of the Christian church.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, going to that first theme that you draw out, the world before Christianity, I think many people are simply unaware of just how different the world is because of the things that this Jesus movement began in terms of our regard for human life, for the poor, for the equality of men and women. Because if you actually go back to Greco-Roman times, in effectively very cultured times in their day and age, it's shocking, actually, some of the attitudes that they had towards children, women, and the poor. Do you want to give some examples of what your own sort of research as a scholar has uncovered in terms of some of the attitudes that prevailed before the advent of Christianity?
Absolutely. I mean, to sum it up, Justin, before Jesus came to the world, life was essentially hell on earth. It was not a pretty place. You talk about a dystopian existence, poverty, slavery, prostitution. The abuse of women and children were commonplace. It was a world of suffering. 25% of the Roman Empire was sick, dying, or in need of immediate medical attention. There was no such thing as social justice programs. There was no such thing as caring or giving to the poor. In fact, the opposite is true. Most of the Roman thinkers, like Seneca and others, actually spoke out against giving to the poor because, really, you could not distill the poor from even the slave class. It was a world of, Rome was not just a slave economy, it was a slave machine. We talk a lot about 45 million people being in modern day human trafficking. That's the most ever right now. But if you look at it from a percentages, 40% of the Roman Empire was enslaved when Jesus began. And when I say Jesus, Justin, I'm speaking about the historical Jesus. Mm. When he began ministering in the late 20s, it was a world that was very dark. Romans were afraid of everything. They were very superstitious. So I talk about the evil eye. And I think just to illustrate it, especially for all the female listeners right now, I begin the book with a love letter from Hilarion to his wife Alice. It's written in the first century BC. And it's a beautiful letter. And he gets to the point of his letter where he says, "You will have our child before I return from working in Alexandria." He's writing to Oxyrhynchus. And he says, "If it is a boy, keep it. If it is a girl, throw it out." And I think that is so illustrative of what the world was like, especially for women and children. And what changed that, without a doubt? And what changed the terrible, by the way, it was a world of incredible racism in the first century. You know, Justin, we talk a lot in higher ed and the ivory tower about Plato and Aristotle. Something I'd love to do a show with you on in the future is the Greek classical thinkers literally invent racism. They had a word called barbaroi in Greek, barbarian. That's what every non-Greek speaker was thought to sound like, just a babbler. And what causes racism to recede at the end of the fourth century? It is Christianity. Mm. And I know you've interviewed him, Rodney Stark, but I wanted to test all of my research nearly 2 years. Great thing about this book, Justin, for anyone who disagrees with me or people that want to go deeper, there's nearly 40 pages of citations, and you can brush up on your German and French while you're reading some of the original sources. So Christianity causes racism to recede, and guess what? No great thinker, no great scholar, no great writer picks it up again until when? The Age of Enlightenment.
It's a really interesting observation, and what you go on to having sort of spelled out the conditions and the way the pre-Christian world was and the Greco-Roman world and the way that Christianity effectively came and transformed that in terms of people's attitudes to equality and human life and dignity and everything. You then do talk about the way that, yes, with the Enlightenment and specifically in the late 19th, early 20th century, suddenly the rise of a certain form of secularism actually gave rise to certain ideas creeping back in around human life and who should and shouldn't live and that sort of thing, particularly with, you know, names that are familiar to many atheists, Bertrand Russell, Nietzsche and others. So do you want to just give us a flavor of what you're sketching out in that section of the book?
Absolutely. In part two, I look at the world without Christianity, because we actually can look at what happened in very recent history when a great majority of the world turned its back on God, and specifically the Judeo-Christian motif. And that world is a very scary world. And I take the reader, again, I wrote this book for busy people like my wife. You know, my wife, you know, we have five kids, including triplet babies. So even if someone's listening to this program and they don't know any of the prerequisites, I've written it in such a way where you're going to get a great understanding of these big thinkers, because we do not realize how Ludwig Feuerbach, Charles Darwin, Karl Marx, the worst of the lot, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Sigmund Freud utterly destroyed the mind and the soul of a significant part of humanity. When we look at the fact that Karl Marx, when he said that, and many of the things, by the way, that Marx said were ripped off from other people, like when he said, you know, religion is the opium of the masses. That's not original to Karl Marx, by the way, but he made the statement famous. He thought that the whole world was thought up in materialistic terms. And, oh, really? How did that work out? I mean, Justin, when you think 68 years ago, more than one half of the world's population was under communist rule, atheistic regime, how did that work out? And I think, and you know, your program's talked about it a lot. I mean, when you just look at the body count of these anti-God regimes, it's not pretty. And I've been to Cuba. I've ministered in Cuba, the last quote-unquote stronghold of a communist country, and the people are hopeless. And yet there is a spiritual hunger. And if the legacy of communism and these anti-God and what we can say about fascism and Nazism specifically, Hitler had a very odd and strange pantheism, but yeah, what we can say is he was against the Christian church. We can say that emphatically. In fact, as I studied him for this book, there's several neat things that I think I draw out that others haven't. For example, Hitler's whole church question. Well, I mean, we know how he answered the Jewish question. Could you imagine if the man had time to answer the church question? So without a doubt, I think it's very important that thinkers out there realize how destructive some of these ideas were in the very recent history for Western civilization. And you know what? In most of the cases, these people, what people don't realize is that without God, it's just law of the jungle. Without God, you know, there is no humanity.
It's an interesting one, Jeremiah, because, and obviously we have a number of non-Christians and atheists who listen to The Unbelievable Show, and I can imagine a lot of them thinking at this point, okay, well, you may be able to convince me that there's a case that Christianity did have this effect on the world that introduced so many of the values that we hold dear today. And perhaps there was a rescinding of that at a certain point in our history, you know, when a kind of a scientistic kind of bent took root and people started talking about survival of the fittest as though that was something we should institute culturally and sociologically. But many people today would say, but we've got beyond that. Nowadays, whether you're a believer or not, whether you're a Christian or not, we all know what's best for humanity. So do we really need religion anymore to help us to be good? Can't we just, you know, forget the stuff of religion and just keep the principles and carry on now sort of for the good of humanity? What's your answer to that kind of a logic which says religion may have been helpful at one time in helping us to steer us in a certain direction, but we don't really need it anymore? We can be masters of our destiny and create the kind of world that is good for everyone.
Well, without God, it's very clear, and I discuss this and I quote ethicists throughout the book, without God, ethics can take any form, even exceedingly wicked forms, as we saw in the atheist and anti-Christian regimes that I point out in Unimaginable. And listen, I'm not speaking in theory. This is not opinion. The dreadful facts of these regimes speak for themselves. And yeah, Justin, I hear a lot about shared values. But again, this goes back to Karl Marx, who had a shared set of values. And to him, it was okay if a great majority of the human herd could be culled for those shared values. So we see there, and according to many ethicists, without religion, the coherence of an ethic of compassion cannot be established. And what am I saying? Well, let me be clear. There are wonderful atheists in the world, many of whom I would love to be my next door neighbors. These are good people, but I don't, and I think they recoil at many of the mass murder, genocide, eugenics that's been done in the name of atheism. But I don't think they can really work out and draw out the implications of a worldview without God, because there is no moral basis.
And as far as you're concerned, the values they do espouse are, in a sense, what a Judeo-Christian history has handed down to them in many ways, I suppose.
Absolutely, because without a doubt, I mean, when we want to do good for someone who's hurting, when we want to turn the other cheek, when our family, we had to evacuate recently from Hurricane Harvey, Justin, and I was just astounded that Christians, and let me be very clear, the Church of Jesus Christ, Christian churches were coming together, helping the 179,000 Houstonians who lost homes rebuild our lives. And my only challenge to many of those humanists and secularists and people who claim no religion at all is, you know, where are all the atheist tents? You know, when my family was evacuated from Hurricane Harvey, I saw Christians showing up in the weeks and months, spending money and helping people, because in our belief system, we help those who are hurting, and it doesn't matter who they are or what they are. And I get really passionate about this point because, Justin, I know you've been in the marginalized world as well, and you've seen the impact that Christianity is making across the world, and I think it's the greatest evidence. I agree with your book, Unbelievable. It's the greatest evidence for this, for what our faith is doing today.
It's been so good to talk to you, Jeremiah. And I'm reminded when you talk about that, you know, the fact that you guys had to be evacuated from Houston. You know, not an easy thing when you've got five children, three of whom are triplets, young children. That this book was actually in its final proofing stages at that point. So it's had a rather a turbulent time actually, you know, reaching us anyway. But the it's here now, and I really do appreciate it. Unimaginable. What our world would be like without Christianity. Just a fascinating insight into what the world was like before Christianity, what Christianity did for the world, and just asking what would happen if we lost it. It's available now. It's published out in the US by Bethany House. It's available, though, of course, online at all good bookshops and so on, and we'll make sure there's a link from today's show to it. And I just want to say again, thank you, Jeremiah, for coming on the program to talk about it.
Justin, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate everything you're doing with Unbelievable.
You're unbelievable.
Well, I'm going to wish you a very happy new year as we close out Unbelievable for 2017. Look forward to seeing you in 2018. We'll be doing some proper apologetics. Yes, we've been debating the whole enterprise of apologetics. We return to doing apologetics next week as we meet a street epistemologist, Pasco Rapace. He's going to be in conversation as an atheist with Christian apologist Cameron Bertuzzi. Should be an interesting discussion. Hope you can join me for it. In the meantime, I'll say a goodbye, a happy new year, and coming up next, The Profile. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.